Okay, good evening, everybody. It's lovely to have a more robust group as the holidays have calmed down. Welcome to 2024, whatever that means. Whatever that means for you. One of my intentions for this year is to really think about how I can offer myself more as a teacher. Offer myself more to those who think of me as a mentor in this practice. And I've begun creating. Here is a first draft of a practice text, which in the Indian traditions is called a sadhana, which basically means a daily form of practice. And the reason I have created this is, it's multifold. The first is that Zen practice has been recontextualized. Much of Zen teaching in the past took place in the life of the temple or the monastery. And of course, there were lay practitioners, but the way the holisticness of learning Zen would happen was going through the daily routine and all of the different ways one was trained and the mind was turned in the temple life. And well, you could say if you come to Wednesday night, you drop into the digital temple once a week, which is lovely. But most of us are not interacting with those kind of environments. And so, if we're only practicing sitting meditation at home, it can become a little bit lopsided. And so, that's one reason why I'm creating this practice so that it's a more holistic immersion of the Dharma were you to go through this on a daily basis. The other reason, in parallel with that, is it's become increasingly important for me to bring my influences as a practitioner into my teaching. And for almost as long as I've practiced Zen, I've been studying and then later practicing in the Indo-Tibetan tradition. And so, especially the Dzogchen tradition is very dear to my heart. And something that I think is one of my Dzogchen teachers said, Zen and Dzogchen are cousins. And so I'm trying to bring what's appropriate of that into the Zen practice that I offer because I think it is very helpful. So, I don't want to spend too much time talking about those things. What I want to do is go through this text. Now, this text, I can share it with you if you're interested. You might go through the whole text as a daily practice. That's the ultimate intention. But better than not doing that is doing what aspects of it actually speak to you. And so, I'm going to go through it part by part. Over the next few weeks, I don't really know how long that's going to take. But there's not so much value in chanting something, reciting something, or doing a practice without understanding why we do it really is not so meaningful if we do something out of compulsion or just because it's a tradition. Or because someone else said it's good for us to do. If we understand why we do it, we're more likely to do it wholeheartedly, and for some reason, we're more likely to get the benefit if we understand what the point is. So that's what I'm going to do, is I'm going to go through and explain these different aspects of the practice. This is sequential. I'm following a traditional format that one would follow in an Indo-Tibetan practice. And the very first thing is clearing the energy channels with the 9 breaths. And those of you who joined for the meditation at the beginning heard me talk about this. Now, the most well-known Zen text by Dogen Zenji called the Fukan Zazengi, Universal Instructions for Zazen, after describing taking the posture, Dogen says something, to paraphrase, something like, and then inhale deeply and exhale completely. And that's basically, in Zen style, the stripped-down version of this practice. There are different traditions of Zen, and they're less transmitted to the West, interestingly, less popular, that focus much more on the energetics of meditation. Teachings that have lineages that have more extensive focus on how do you work with the channels and the chakras, right? A lot of Zen people, as soon as you say chakra, they're like, oh no, this is a new age guy. And they kind of, they run, whether they run with their minds or they literally turn off the Zoom or leave the room. But for example, when we work with the Tanden, the Hara, that energy center below the belly button, which almost all Zen traditions have some appreciation of, we're working with the chakra, right? The Manipura chakra. So this is part of Zen practice, working with the energy channels. The main way that we work with the energy channels in Zen, is with good meditation posture. And that is something I find very hard to teach over Zoom. If you were having meditation instruction with me at Heart of Wisdom Temple, it'd be very easy for me to give you feedback about your posture. And for a lot of people, that would be really a beneficial thing to have somebody look at our meditation posture, because it does affect the flow of energy. The main point of it, which is directly related to energy flow, is relaxation and an upright spine. The main channel of energy that feeds energy into the arteries of the chakras is the central channel, which runs through the spine. That's why the posture, the upright posture, one of the reasons it's emphasized. So that's implicit here. I'm not mentioning that, but moving on to the energy channels itself. So without getting into, without bogging things down with esoteric teaching, of course, you can find diagrams for this. It is taught in most of the energy systems of Buddhism that there's the central channel, which roughly corresponds to the midline of the body. And then there are two side channels that go from the nostrils and they go down, down the body, and they join the central channel right below the navel, which is where the hara is, the tanden that you hear a lot in Zen training. So in this practice, we are clearing all three channels, the left channel, the right channel, and the central channel. And they have beautiful Sanskrit names. I think Ida and Pingala, that's the left and the right. And there's a name for the central channel, the Sushumna, not so important. Although I could just say the word Pingala over and over. I just love how that sounds. Pingala. Beautiful. There are different ways to do this practice, and frankly, because I've experienced different lineages teach it in different ways, what that says to me is it doesn't exactly matter how you do it. There's something in common with all of these traditions. So the first thing is that you inhale deeply, and then you close one nostril, and you exhale completely through the other, all the way down to the very bottom. So there's no air left in your lungs. Now, in Buddhist yogic understanding, air and energy are not the same thing. Oxygen, the breath, carries prana, but prana is independent of the breath. Prana meaning life force, equivalent with chi or ki. So what we're doing here is we're clearing our channels by using intentionality and the breath. You could say intentionality and prana in order to allow the free flow of prana. As a theory, I wouldn't blame any of you for going, wow, this sounds rather kind of fancy and metaphysical. The important thing is to do the practice and be present with the effect in your, let's call it, more subtle body. There is this gross, not meaning gross, but the gross matter body. And then there is an energy body. We could, you could say it's close to thinking that there's the physical body of flesh, muscle, bone, blood, etc. And then there's the nervous system, right? And they're not the same thing. You can have a very tired and even painful physical flesh, bone, body, but your nervous system can be clear and calm. They're related, but they're different. So whether you take it as the subtle body or the nervous system, we're clearing the nervous system, you could say. So back to the instruction. You close one nostril and you inhale through the open nostril. Excuse me. Okay, so here's what I'm doing. Can you see me? Not everybody can. You can't see me super well. Okay, right now I have one of my fingers over my left nostril. Okay, I start there. I inhale through my right nostril, then I move my finger over, and then I exhale through the left. And then I repeat that. I don't just stay on the alternation. Inhale through the right nostril. Exhale completely through the left. And I do that 3 times on each side. Okay? After 3 times on each side, then you inhale through both nostrils and you exhale completely through both. You'll notice that at times one nostril, regardless of snot or mucus, is more open than the other. And it starts to give you some sense of, oh yeah, there is something to the energy channels being open or closed. The ancient yogic texts talk about the energy channels being, the different channels being open at different times of the day and so forth. All of that's interesting. The main thing is to do this and experience the effect. Now in Dharma, everything is mind. This is what the Buddha said. It's so commonly repeated in the teachings that the profundity of this statement can so easily be lost on us. This is like as mind-blowing as anything of quantum physics. If we think about how we ordinarily think about what life is, the Buddha said that everything is mind. Everything is made from mind. Everything flows from mind. There is nothing but mind. In that spirit, when you do this practice, you are traditionally invited to feel / visualize that you are inhaling light. You inhale luminosity. So you would visualize / feel the breath as luminosity. Sometimes this is said that you inhale the vital chi of your environment. Now, if you're practicing in your car in downtown Portland, you're probably not going to inhale the vital chi of your environment. But if you actually happen to have kind of plants around and you're in a place that has trees and clear air, this is even more meaningful. Nonetheless, prana, energy, is independent of the physical environment. So by visualizing light, that intention connects you with more subtle energy. people who are down with Reiki are with me here. Some of you are a little bit like meh, and that's okay. Inhale light, you exhale, visualizing smoke or some kind of thick, usually dark colored substance. That has the quality of letting go of toxins. You could also think of it as a way of demarcating that now you're entering the space where you're going to relinquish whatever kind of moody negativity you might have been marinating in. I don't know, if you're like me, then you marinate in moody negativity sometimes. It's actually like one of our hobbies is to do so. We have some strange attraction to it. This exhaling of the smoke, or however you visualize it, is partly saying, I'm letting that go now. I'm separating from ordinary mind, which loves to chew on suffering. It loves to. This is the first interruption of ordinary mind. One of the early instructions I received in this practice, it says something like, after you do the 9 breaths, you rest in the experience of wisdom prana. And what they mean is take a moment and feel the subtle energy shifts. Some of you might be able to feel it very clearly at this point in your practice that you're left with after doing that practice. You register the effect. Okay? So that is the first practice. This practice and all of the other practices, if it is beneficial, or maybe if some of you see me one-on-one, we think it's the best, you might spend longer with a particular practice. When I was first discovering meditation as a teenager, I found all these texts on prana control, on pranayama, which is basically where this kind of stuff comes from. And I did a lot of this energy clearing work, and I think it really served me. Yeah. Because again, the basis for our practice is our physical body, it's our mind, and it's also our energy body. Our energy body is also a factor in the quality of our practice. So for some people, this might be worth dwelling on. Okay. Then the next element is a proclamation. Homage to Mother Prajnaparamita and all the Buddhas. So if you were practicing at home, you would read that out loud. We begin here by chanting this. We touch into just how large this mystery is. So Mother Prajnaparamita refers to that wisdom which belongs to no one but is the womb of everyone. That wisdom which is the source of all good things, but which can never be grasped. And in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, this was anthropomorphized as the goddess Mother Prajnaparamita. It's the mother because it's the womb from which life arises. In other words, space. Everything depends on, is born from, and dissolves back into space. It's not just physical space, because what in the world allowed physical space to arise in the first place? When I was younger, I was very fascinated by this question. I had this koan that came to me as a little boy, and that was, well, if there's a God, what was before God? In other words, if there's a creator of the universe, how did there be a place for the creator to create? How could there be a first thing? Mother Prajnaparamita is pointing to this miracle that there is always an openness that allows. And all wisdom and all wisdom teachings come out of that openness that allows. Prajnaparamita means perfection of wisdom, and sometimes we say it's wisdom beyond wisdom. This space of awareness that all the practices are about is something utterly ordinary in that it's always here. It's the ground of everything we experience, and yet it's also something so profound we can never fathom it. We can never grasp it as an object. So that's part of what that line means. It means wisdom comes from the source that belongs to no one. All the Buddhas come from this space that we practice in these teachings. So the next aspect of the text is traditionally the four thoughts that turn to mind. And as I've been working on this, I feel like it can really be condensed down to three. Now, any of you who have a connection with less more conservative Buddhist teachers, they would definitely scorn me playing with this at all. I left out death from these four contemplations because I feel like it's included in all three of these. So, the four thoughts that turn the mind, in this instance, it's the three contemplations. These are something to remind us of why we practice. There's something to remind us of what reality is. They are an encouragement to connect with the sobriety of wisdom. And the sobriety of wisdom is really important because most of us, and I don't know any of you all that well, to be honest, I don't know your life and your struggles, but most of us in current modern America have a pretty comfortable life. We have pretty consistent safety. We have pretty consistent abundance of material goods. And therefore, it is super easy to lose zest for spiritual practice. It's really easy to get disconnected from the logic of awakening. Why would I do this work to find what we could call a transcendent intuition or a transcendent quality of being when I don't need a transcendent quality of being because my life is already pretty good? It's a question that we will all face, and we do face. Even on a daily basis, we might encounter the sense of, I don't really feel like meditating. We might get disconnected from the logic of practice. So these are basic reminders of the logic of practice that one of my teachers calls them alchemical contemplations. And that is, they're to be done, they're to be recited and read and really chewed on. The idea is not that you go, oh yeah, okay, that's what some people think is true. Sounds good to me. I'll sign under the dotted line. The idea is that you think about their implications so that they really affect you. And then they become alchemical contemplations. They actually change the way we see life. So, for instance, the first one is about karma. Basic teaching of karma is that, well, as one famous American teacher said, we don't get away with anything. Our actions of body, speech, and mind will have an effect. None of them that arise outside of mindfulness are going to be without their consequence. So we are reminding ourselves that how we orient throughout the day really matters. And why do we need to do this? That seems really obvious, actually. Doesn't karma seem kind of obvious most of the time? I think it seems kind of obvious, but what we don't think about is that actions that we are taking now are actually being sent downstream to our future self. The place, maybe you could argue and say, that's not true. I'm very keen on sending money downstream to my 70-year-old self who's going to be retired, hopefully. I'm very keen on my 401k or my Roth IRA or whatever it is. So materially, we understand karma and we invest in our future self or in our future loved ones, but we don't think about that spiritually. We don't tend to think that today and the next day and all the rest of the year, I am cultivating the mind that my self 10 years from now, 20 years from now, maybe even in the next lifetime, is going to inherit. I'm cultivating that mind. Or to put it positively, I can cultivate that mind. What kind of heart would I like to have 5 or 10 years from now? What kind of companion would I like to be 5 or 10 years from now? Yeah. What kind of seeds among my loved ones, my community, my work, my projects do I want to plant now to bear fruit later? That's part of what karma is pointing at. Moments of mind, utterances of speech, actions of body, creative power shaping the future and the past. Therefore, channeling them into the great love, Buddha's pathless path. So the mind state I have now, the things I do, the things I say, shapes the future, shapes what's going to come down the pipe. Some of that, I think, seems obvious to us, and some of it is more subtle. Who we resonate into our field of experience, the kind of companions who come our way, has something to do with our state of mind. Everybody has an experience of this. We don't tend to think of our moments of mind and actions of body and speech as affecting our past, but how we see and experience the effects of the past have to do with our state of mind right now. If we're practicing the karma, the positive karma of a grateful state of mind, then everything that has happened to us becomes seen and experienced differently in that light. If we're practicing the state of mind of resentment and feeling like we are, we've been dealt a purely terrible hand by the forces of the universe, then that shapes how we see everything that has happened to us. The place we look from in this moment, the state of mind we have right now, affects our past and our future and our present, because everything is mind. You could say outlook affects everything. reciting something like this is a contemplation that develops over time. I was reading Lama Rod's new book called The New Saints, which I highly recommend. It's fantastic. And there's a section on karma in there, and he said, I don't really like to talk about karma because almost no one understands it. And I think that's true. The Buddha was known for saying that the workings of karma are so intricate that only a fully awakened one can fully fathom them. A way to think about this is that in our deeper moments of practice, in our moments of most intimate clarity, what karma is becomes more intimately verified. We can understand it. So the hope is that by connecting with a teaching like this over months and years, that in those moments of clarity, this what this points at becomes more evident. So in a lot of ways, karma is obvious. In a lot of ways, it's not so obvious. And we have to just trust that it becomes verified as we continue practicing. So the next contemplation is on the precious human birth. And you know, the tenor of the old contemplations was often kind of fire and brimstone-y. It was sort of like, you've got this precious human birth. You were not born a stray dog, a fish, or, you know, into a war zone. And so you better practice. That was kind of the tenor, trying to actually motivate people through negativity. But I think we can connect with this as an appreciation of, first of all of us, if we stop and look, as painful as it may be, we can see that this life is slipping away. It's slipping away so quickly. And the older you get, it's almost like each, you know, every decade, it's like the reality of this accelerates. The older you get, the more you realize you have less time. And the transiency of life is really evident. This is a reminder, this contemplation, that the chance to really unfold the richness of the spiritual life is slipping between our fingers. And how beautiful it is that we still have the chance. We still have the chance. Those of you who are here tonight, as far as I can tell, we all have the capacities. We have the convergences that allow us to do this practice that we can touch the sacred. Truly, every person can touch the divine, can touch the unconditioned, the Buddha nature. And touch is a phrase that I inherited from Hogen Roshi. He liked to say we touch it, meaning we may not be able to fully live in awareness of the sacred. We may not be able to fully awaken in this lifetime and leave confusion behind. But even tasting the timeless depth, there's all kinds of words I could use and they all seem so paltry. Even brief, genuine glimpses can change our life. A genuine glimpse of true nature gives what I would call a ballast, a background, in a way, a background of meaning for all the ridiculousness and all the pain that we might have to experience and that other people definitely we can see experience. Touching the sacred redeems the absurdity of human life. And so that's what precious human birth is about. It's not saying that you shouldn't spend your time doing those things that you think the Buddha would think you shouldn't be doing. It's not really about that. It's about appreciating the opportunity. That's all. That's all. If we contemplate impermanence and we can avoid getting off course into despair or nihilism, eventually it will positively change our life. Eventually. Sometimes it takes a while, because living into the truth of transiency is exactly what human beings do not want to do. I'll repeat that. Living into the truth of transiency is everything that human beings don't want to really face up to. And so much of human life is about trying to build some kind of castle, some version of an immortality project, in all the different ways that we try to do that. So, precious human birth is just reminding us of something very beautiful. Yeah. And then the third contemplation, I think I want to change this so it doesn't say suffering, because I really despise that word. I made a commitment a few years ago that I would go a whole year in teaching and not use the word suffering. And I think I did okay on that. This is a reminder that nothing is going to really, truly hit the spot other than waking up. And, you know, I can say that, but if I look at my life, I haven't 100% been able to live into that truth. My life is a contradiction. I know that that's true, and yet I definitely put energy into things that aren't really going to hit the spot, right? And that's part of my work, is to bring what I know to be true, most true, in more alignment with how I live my life. And I don't know how far I'll get this time around, but the root illusion of the separately existing self, the root illusion of permanence, the root illusion of separation. We can't go anywhere, get any job, taste any meal, meet any person that's going to alleviate us of the suffering of the root illusion. Can't happen, will never happen, ain't gonna happen. And so this is just a reminder that we're all in this boat. We are born into a spiritual crisis. That's basically what the Buddha meant with the Four Noble Truths. We're born into a spiritual crisis, and we respond to that in different ways. And this kind of contemplation, as it penetrates more and more, we respond to this truth of being born into a spiritual crisis more and more directly. More and more directly. The intimate distress of the heart will not be relieved by anything outside of ourselves. The work of doing our intimate work is supported by many things, including companions, including safety, including beauty, including our friends and teachers. Absolutely. But essentially, that is a matter of clarifying what our own mind is. Yeah? The root illusion is we're not 100% clear on what our own mind is. It's wild. We can create nanobots. We have created nanobots that can be injected into your bloodstream, and they know how to get to whatever they need to repair. We've cloned animals. We've left the galaxy. Yet very few of us actually know what our own mind is. So, if you are to practice with this text, and if you were to do this section, you just recite these and you take a little bit of time and you feel into their truth. Yeah. And if they're working, at least sometimes, it will be motivating. It will remind you of why you're sitting on a cushion at 6 a.m. when you could still be in bed, or fill in the blank of your version of that. It will connect you to the sobriety of wisdom that does this practice. Because the parts of us that only want to have fun and the parts of us that like to be lazy, they're there, but they don't like to do Dharma practice, right? In a way, we do this practice for those parts of us. They get the benefit, but they're not going to actually sit down and do the practice. So that's the three contemplations. I think that's good for today. I want to continue with this text.